America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. America's relationship with China is downright perplexing when you consider the many factors that bind us and the equally strong elements that pull us apart. We're trading partners, economic rivals, and potentially opponents or enemies who play strategic chess trying to determine what the actions of one party means to the global security interests of the other. Confused? We'll do our best to sort it all out today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Isaac Stone Fish. And he's written really a fascinating book that we all have to get our arms around and think about the issues that he portrays in the book, America Second. And he's got a prize. We only win second prize, how America's elites are making China stronger. And Isaac, I don't have to tell you, as somebody who has, of course, spent a lot of time in China, you know your subject very well, but you're also an American. And we don't like to think of ourselves as second. We're kind of like the Yankees. Even though they don't win every year, they think they're still the champions. So, America, are we on the verge of really allowing ourselves to slip economically, culturally, perhaps, behind the Chinese? What's happening?
We very well might be, and I want people to wake up to the fact that there are a lot of global trends pushing against America's favor, and we need to be having a national debate about what we want to do with the rise of China. Do we want to push back against the Chinese Communist Party? Do we believe that America should not be the global hegemon? And in both those cases, what should we do about it?
Well, I think America is very confused. First of all, we don't know what to call China in terms of its relationship with America. Are we competitors? Are we adversaries? Are we near enemies? Or are we trading partners totally interdependent on one another?
Are we all of the above, frenemies of state, as some people will have it? I think you're very right to point out naming, because what we call China, what we call this period, is so incredibly important. There's a debate, is this a Cold War? Is this not a Cold War? And I think the consensus is, well, it's something different, but we don't really have a good title for it yet.
But what does it look like to you as somebody who's been on the ground in China? I mean, you obviously really respect the Chinese people. What we're really talking about here is the party. So let's put it on the table. When I'm dealing with a business in China, not that I am, but I always am as a consumer, who am I dealing with?
You're dealing with a wide variety of potential people, but you're dealing with a business that has deep ties with the Chinese Communist Party, whether they like it or not. And I think to step back and outlay the situation, the Chinese Communist Party keeps increasing its tentacles into most facets of Chinese life. And when we deal with Chinese interlocutors, we're more often than not dealing with folks who are approved by the party. And in terms of the trend and where we are, where we're going, the U.S. and China's relationship continues to worsen, will likely continue to worsen from here. And amidst the Russian invasion of Ukraine, many people are asking, and it's an important question to ask, will Beijing invade Taiwan in the near term? And if so, what would the United States do about it?
And what would we do about it? I'm very confused even about the relationship that we have with Taiwan. In other words, we definitely see them as an ally. We rely upon them for our semiconductors. They are a forward-looking democratic society, and yet we have to be very careful as to what we call them based upon what mainland China believes they represent or who they are or how they are, in fact, part of China.
The United States government sees Taiwan as an ally, but not as a country. And there's this absurd dance that the government's been playing with Beijing for decades over the status of Taiwan, which has steadily decreased on the global stage. There's a lot of people in the U.S. government, especially in Congress, who want to see a more muscular stance towards China and Taiwan. But really, the question will be, when Beijing invades Taiwan, the President of the United States will wake up that morning and make a very momentous decision.
Now, President Xi, he represents a lot of what the confusion about our relationship is. In other words, he was in the United States for years. Lots of people who became very powerful and influential say that they have a good relationship with him. And yet his stranglehold over the party is greater than anything we've seen since Mao Zedong. And he is locking down China in so many ways and bringing it back to a place that, well, for many, is abusive of human rights and really more despotic than it's been in, again, a very long time. So yet he came to the United States and he saw what America offered, and many thought that he was much more progressive. You talk a lot about the elite academic institutions, Hollywood, how they have all become transfixed with both the market of China and perhaps the way that China actually does things. And we're trying to figure out whether it's good to have a lot of foreign students from China here, whether they go back and try to say America's a good place to do business and to be friendly with, or, as some think, some of them, at least a percentage, are spies. Help us to understand all of this.
It's a very complicated world, so I'll address those pieces one by one. So Chairman Xi has spent some time in the United States, but it's good for us to remember that living, visiting, going to college in the United States does not a reformer make. Charles Taylor, the Liberian warlord, went to college in the United States. Kim Jong-un studied in Switzerland, the North Korean dictator. No. Hitler studied in Austria from Germany.
I've got
from
you.
The Western world
I've got itself. It, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think on the question of universities, it's such a difficult. So the way that the Chinese would see this, and it's a crude analogy, but Deng Xiaoping would say, well, you open the window and you let in some flies. And for the Chinese Communist Party, the idea was, well, we do need to learn from the foreigners, but we don't want to import too much bourgeois imperialism. And for the United States, the question is, well, yes, people coming into this country will, some of them will steal intellectual property, some of them will bully other Chinese students, but we want to keep our commitment to freedom of speech and open inquiry, even when the other side isn't doing it. And there's a concept in academic freedom of, what is it? Sort of, it's a, you know, small yard, high fences, where you make it very, very difficult to transfer the really sensitive technology and leave everything else quite open. And I think we're understanding there needs to be more of a hybrid approach to what Beijing is doing. And I think for universities themselves, they need to understand that the U.S. government is going to want to crack down on leakages. And the more that universities can control the narrative and the method, the more freedom that they'll have against what the U.S. government is doing.
Well, how does the U.S. government protect itself from becoming censors in some sense, worried about the many implications of a growing relationship with China, but a China that is so locked down within the context of the Communist Party that, in fact, we can't trust the motivations for so many of the interactions that our business people have, that our cultural ambassadors have, that we can't trust that that's a real relationship, that it's not one that's going one way and with a lot of information, material, leaving the United States.
That's a great point. As I talk about in my book, America Second, a real question is, how do we push back against Beijing without being more like Beijing? And there's a real debate among the journalist community. It's very difficult to get a journalist visa to China, yet it's relatively easy for Chinese, whether they work for state-owned media or merely state-linked media, to get visas to the United States. And so there's a lot of question about reciprocity. However, the United States doesn't want to be in the business of banning journalists from coming to its shores. And so it's a real case by case. How do we prevent, say, a Chinese student who's spying for the Ministry of State Security to get into a classroom and cast a chill on other Chinese students without reducing the academic freedom of U.S. students and global students and Chinese students as a whole? It's a very, very difficult line to walk.
Are we really able to thread the needle? I've got to tell you that years ago I did a podcast with a gentleman who had written a book, and I remember in the opening of the book he was talking about the Chinese relationship, and I believe it was Rupert Murdoch who went over to China, and he was having a meeting with all these Chinese businessmen, and he was kind of laughing with them, saying, you know, everybody tells me I've got to worry when I come here that I'm going to be dealing with members of the Chinese party, that it's all under lock and key and control, and I haven't met one yet. And they all looked at him. They all were. I mean, again, and you talk about, well, useful, I'm not going to say idiots by any means, but a lot of people who've been very useful to the Chinese cause, Americans, Jimmy Carter, Madeleine Albright, may she rest in peace, Bob Iger, I mean, many others. I mean, what's Henry Kissinger among them? What's happening here?
For so long, so many Americans suppressed criticism of China, advocated for policies that enabled and strengthened China, often at the expense of U.S. interests. And for a really long time, this really mirrored stated U.S. government policy of strengthening China and preferring a strong, stable China to a weak, stable, or even a weak, chaotic China. And what happened is that Henry Kissinger, the former Secretary of State, trailblazed a consulting industry with former foreign dignitaries. And in the legal world, in the financial world, in the accounting world, in so many other worlds, in the medical world, there's such a strong concept of conflict of interest, where if a pharmaceutical company pays you money to advocate for a drug, people might think your judgment is a little bit suspect, but the foreign policy world doesn't have those ideas. And I think what we saw is when you don't force people to register as lobbyists, when you don't force people to disclose who their clients are, to say who they're advocating for, you have a lot of times where very prominent people will advocate for things that benefit their bottom line at the expense of American interests.
But aren't there laws on the books? You've got to help us understand that. There's a lot of foreign influence regulation. Why did they not fall under that?
So Foreign Agent Registration Act is when you're working directly for a foreign entity, and the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which regulates the ability to give money to a foreign government. But so often what has happened is that these people would work for U.S. businesses and help the U.S. businesses succeed in China. So it was a step removed. Not to say Kissinger and Albright didn't work directly for Chinese companies. They both did in their years as a consultant. But the more problematic one is working for companies, Coca-Cola, Boeing, Microsoft, that were seeming to advance their interests in China in a way that were harmful for policies in the United States. I should caveat here that I also run a consulting business. And the idea is not that, you know, one can go into a consulting business and have an objective view on these lofty foreign policy concepts. But certainly clients that I have and positions that I hold are influenced by the money that I make. Rather, it's a question of transparency and being open that because of all of these ties that we have, it changes the way we think and talk about things.
America Second, how America's elites are making China stronger. I just don't know how long we can do business the way we're doing business with China without getting a lot smarter about what it is that we really have as an objective in all of this. I know Americans have gotten used to lower prices, Isaac. I'm one of those. Clearly, I mean, we've seen that, but we've also seen the impacts when things aren't made here. We have supply chain interruptions. We've got workers who are idled across the country. So there have been all of these downsides that have been explored and have helped the political fortunes of people like Donald Trump over the years. So what are we really vying with in terms of concepts here as we look at emerging China that is getting more dictatorial, more abusive of human rights? Where is this headed as you see it?
There's three aspects here. One is the growing ethical concern of overexposure to China because of the genocide in the northwest region of Xinjiang, because of deeper party control. The second is the national security considerations and that perennial debate about how much should U.S. businesses work in concert or work against the U.S. government. And the third is just the concept of risk and the idea that as the party grows more unpredictable, as it takes a deeper turn towards the left under Xi Jinping, as supply chain disruptions become a fact rather than a bug of the global system, so many U.S. businesses are mispricing their China risk and haven't understood the cost of manufacturing in China from a risk-adjusted perspective.
When we look at Chinese companies, and again, I just want to get back to this point because it's something that alludes to me. When I see a Jack Ma and I see that he was growing into the next Jeff Bezos and then I see he disappeared, I wondered, first of all, who gave him the ability to become that billionaire who was going to end up in the sights of the party? I'm just going to call it the party from this point on. And what happened to him? And who can we think we're dealing with when we are dealing with companies? And we're dealing with companies over there all the time. Who do we have to imagine is pulling the strings, whether they're called private, state-sponsored, state-owned, state-subsidized? I mean, explain the differential, if there is any difference, really.
There is a difference, but it's a difference of degree rather than type for most of these. So Alibaba is one of the largest, quote-unquote, private companies in China. But Jack Ma, as we saw so publicly with his disappearance, owes his safety and his success to the Communist Party. And he might personally despise the party. He might really wish that he were operating in a system where he didn't have to follow the dictates of the party, but he very much does. So the issue is not that all of these people are brainless apparatchiks. They're certainly not. Jack Ma is a brilliant businessman. The issue is that he understands which side his bread is buttered on and that he cannot go against the party without being crushed. And what probably happened was his disappearance was a warning to him about moving against the party, about going out in ways that the party felt were against their interests. And so when you're dealing with someone who works for a Chinese company, they in some way, whether they know it or not, have to reflect the interests of the Communist Party.
So let's get back to America. I just did a podcast that we haven't posted as of this taping called The Red Carpet about Hollywood.
It's a fantastic book.
Yeah, it is. And the way that Hollywood has manipulated China, you want our market? Well, then take off that emblem that Tom Cruise is wearing in the new Top Gun that symbolized Taiwan. Maybe you need to move this script around just a little bit to reflect some other values, because they recognized that Hollywood, whether meaning to or not, has been the greatest purveyor of American culture, which is one of our greatest soft exports in the world. Everyone wanted to be like America because of our movies. And they saw that as a great propaganda tool, thanks to the U.S. They came here. They got schooled in our marketing, our script development. They began to understand it. And then they recognized that we, just like Khrushchev said many years ago, Isaac, I don't know if you're old enough to remember this, but you're a historian, you study this stuff. He said, America will give us the rope, really, to tie a noose around their neck. That's how much the capitalist system will go out for itself and run afoul of what else is going on in the world that they should be paying attention to. So help me to understand what you think the Hollywood aspect to all of this symbolizes.
The Hollywood aspect is this. Hollywood is the most pro-Beijing sector of the U.S. business community and arguably the most pro-Beijing sector of U.S. society. And it's a great example of combination of economics, globalization, racial politics, left-right divide, and it's really striking that it's taken us this long to wake up to how much Beijing has co-opted Hollywood and what that means. As I describe in my book, America Second, Beijing's influence on Hollywood has led to worse stereotyping of Muslims. It's led to really cartoonish and flat, and I would argue racist portrayal of Chinese people, all in the defense of, well, we can't offend the Chinese Communist Party, therefore, let's only put positive characters into movies. And it's also led to a national security concern of Hollywood movies not being able to express that America's greatest geopolitical threat is in fact such a threat. And let me unpack a little bit what I was talking about, the idea of racism in portrayals of Chinese. So I'm Jewish, and if every Jew in a Hollywood movie was a doctor or a lawyer or a very intelligent accountant, and you had characters saying, gosh, you know, I was in this very complex legal drama and I got my Jewish lawyer to save me, you'd have some real problems from the ADL and a lot of other Jewish advocacy groups, because philo-Semitism is a problem. And if you just portray positives of a race or religion, you're not portraying them realistically. And so for the last decade, really, and for most of the 2000s, we've had these very flat, one-sided portrayals of Chinese people in American movies that doesn't portray them with all of the warts and bumps that characterize humans the world over.
Why are we giving them such control over editorial? Is it because of the market that China represents? And let me get back to the notion that we will sell the rope to hang ourselves if we let economics lead and not our values.
The problem is so many Hollywood studios are so consolidated and are in businesses much larger than just film. Disney is a great example of that. Disney's theme parks, experiences, cruise lines, toys, other consumer goods, and Disney worries that if they do anything that might remotely cause offense to the Chinese Communist Party, or more accurately, that the Communist Party chooses to take offense at, it could jeopardize not just the ability of one single film to open in China, but all of its other business lines as well.
President Biden has really thrown down the gauntlet, democracy versus autocracy, and that the future must belong to democracy. Now, we've had a lot of China envy here in the United States, saying, look how more organized they are, they're more technocratic. They've got a lot of systems for socially determining who you are and what you're doing, but they do it so smartly and keep their society so well organized. And over here, we have a stalemate politically. We're a mess in many ways. And yet, our disorganization at times allows for much more adaptability, much more innovation, and that's the beauty, if not the chaos, of the American system. So the China envy that I see here, what do you see it as representing, and how misguided are we in looking at that model and saying there's something there that we should adapt to?
I lived in Beijing for 6 years, and I think the greatest antidote of China envy is going and living in China. It's far more chaotic than people think, and it makes it a much more enjoyable place to live, but it is, even today, even amidst some of the lockdowns, you know, a very seat-of-the-pants kind of place. And I think it's really this othering that people do where they don't see China as it is. They see it as a reflection of what America isn't. Oh, we have so much partisan strife, and there it's just one party. Oh, it takes so long. There's all these permits and red tapes, and in China, things get done so quickly. And it's really not the reality of the situation in China. I also find it really stunning that many good liberals I talk to will speak with envy about China's ability to fight climate change, forgetting both the huge interpersonal costs of Beijing's methods and also that China is far and away the greatest emitter, and its climate change numbers are moving in the wrong direction. And so I think a lot of what we're going to find now is a battle of rhetoric, and that the way we describe China, the way we describe the party, the way we describe who's winning in globalization and climate change is going to be really important. It's a war of propaganda. I'm sad that Bush ruined the phrase hearts and minds, because I think it's an excellent phrase to describe what the United States and China are fighting for.
Well, when we do talk about the free world today and in the context of what's happening with Russia and Ukraine, we are certainly not afraid to call it out and say that this is such a punitive and disgraceful and unethical and disgusting regime in Russia. Why are we so afraid to call it out as baldly as that at times, when in fact our president is convening nations to talk about democracy versus autocracy? And one could argue that China is the most estimable of all those autocracies in terms of the many implications of what it's trying to do worldwide.
Two reasons. In 2021, we traded 25 times more with China than we did with Russia. Numbers higher today now that Russian trade has all but stopped. And the second is that the American people haven't figured out how to have a very critical conversation on China and the Communist Party without devolving into anti-Asian hate or McCarthyist tendencies. And I think it's so important for us to figure out how to have a competitor, an enemy that is a non-white nation, and to fight them in a way that doesn't increase racial tension and racial hate in this country. I think it's so incredibly important. And for ethical and strategic reasons, we need to be so, so careful about how we have this conversation and how we do it.
You give us ways to fight back that are not in that, as you say, Trumpian approach. Expose unethical and illegal U.S. corporate behavior in China. Partner with U.S. allies. And I think we are trying to rebuild a lot of those relationships in Asia, from South Korea to Australia. I don't know about India, Japan, of course. Then you say, educate Americans to the threat from the party ministries, like the United Front. Explain that to us. And finally, you say ways to stop supporting genocide in that northern province, that Americans have to really take on some responsibility themselves to get some education about what's really happening in China and make a lot of their own value judgments as to how much they do or don't want to support the party by buying a lot of Chinese product.
Ministry I talked about is the United Front Work Department, the United Front for short. And it comes from a Leninist idea of working with the enemy, working with a non-communist party to strengthen the cause of global communism to overthrow the imperialists. In Lenin's case, it was British dock workers. And in Beijing's case, it's foreign business people or Chinese religious groups or Chinese business people. And so the United Front Work Department and the United Front concept is about strengthening China's friends, weakening its enemies, basically making the world safe for the Chinese Communist Party. And it's a very secretive ministry and a very secretive ideology, and one that hasn't been talked about all that much in DC and in policy communities until recently. But it's incredibly important.
You talk about, and I think this is fascinating, our economies are intertwined. However, evidence suggests that the party wants America to yield. It wants America to recognize their mistakes and apologize. Beijing wants America as a reliable and pliant second to China's first, a friend. How can that be, since we always like to see that we're leading a coalition of the free, those who want justice, want individual rights, and now we seem to be more on that track, at least under this administration, than we have been in a long time.
That's how we like to see it domestically, but a lot of the world doesn't agree with our own self-narrative. And one of the reasons why it's so important to wage a global propaganda battle is for those hearts and minds, and convincing folks around the world that their interests are better served by partnering with the United States over China is an incredibly important and useful investment.
You also go on to say, and this is really telling and I think important, that none of us really understands the motivations of the party leadership. It is such a tight circle. And you say that we don't know whether they truly want to destroy our democracy or coexist peacefully with it. And we know historically, China, I'm not talking about the party, and you point out, I think, that the party is a new occurrence. China is a very old and ancient and wonderful civilization, and the party is something relatively new, about 70 or 80 years. So the question is, what do they want, ultimately, America to be? A lapdog that's buying their product, or someone who is totally under their rule, regime, and approach to governance?
It's an important question, and there almost certainly is some debate at the top of the party about what they do want. But I think for so long, Americans have taken bland policy pronouncements in English for what the party actually thinks and not read what they've said in Chinese, not read between the lines, not used analysis to think about it. And so I do feel like there's a lot of support for the idea that Beijing doesn't want the U.S. as the senior partner, but wants it as the junior partner.
Is there any serious decoupling as a result of the pandemic, for example, with all these supply chain problems that are evidencing themselves again, as there is presently a lockdown going on in much of China still dealing in that way with the pandemic? Are we really trying to decouple? Are we really trying to bring a lot of manufacturing back to our shores as you see it?
I'm glad you mentioned the pandemic. The number one reason for U.S.-China decoupling over the last 2 years has been the pandemic. And the number one reason why Beijing is the first nemesis in decoupling, or the first mover of it, is Beijing's paranoid overreaction towards COVID, especially over the last 12 months, and especially over the last several months, when we see examples of atrocities happening in Shanghai, people in one of the great cities of the world starving because they can't get food because they're locked in their apartments. And I think the question of decoupling is really less when, but how much. It's happening now, and it's very sector to sector, and in some cases, company to company, but it's so much more difficult to do business in China, to go around China, to invest in China, because the country is so very closed right now. And when that stops, my best guess is Q1 or Q2 next year, I think there will be a small flood of investment in, but it's really difficult to say.
In closing, what do they think about America? Meaning, do they think that we are a nation that will respond no matter what the challenge? And as one English wag, I think it was Churchill, might have said, America always does the right thing after it tries everything else. In other words, do they see us as a resilient nation that is going to overcome what seem to be a lot of intractable problems with our political system, or do they think that we are on the verge?
One of my favorite things about China is the great multiplicity of viewpoints about Americans and American people. And one thing I'm really looking forward to is when China opens its borders again to get to meet and chat with the Chinese people who come here or will travel around the world. And there can be more of an opportunity to convince them that the U.S. is still that shining city on the hill and not the way that Beijing likes to portray it in Chinese propaganda.
America Second, how America's elites are making China stronger. Isaac Stone Fish. For anyone who is going to be listening to this podcast, I think they're going to have a much better framework for considering the actions of China around the globe and in relation to the United States. I thank you so much for being with us today here on America Trends.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the chat.